Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 162, recorded August 4th, 2014. Kevin Rose. Triangulation is brought to you by Personal Capital. With Personal Capital, you'll finally have all your financial life in one place and get a clear view of everything you own. Best of all, it's free. To sign up, go to personalcapital.com/triangulation. And by SmartThings, the easiest and most affordable way to create a smart home. Protect and control your home from anywhere with no contracts or monthly fees. For 10% off any home security kit, visit smartthings.com/twit and use the code TWIT10 at checkout. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we get some of the most interesting, smartest, most challenging and stimulating people from the world of technology on and spend an hour talking to them. And, oh boy, I'm excited about this show. I've been excited all weekend. Kevin Rose is here. I probably don't need to introduce Kevin Rose. Everybody knows him from the Screensavers days. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, thanks for having me.
From Dig and Dig Nation, which is probably still the best-known podcast in the world.
Come on.
No, I seriously think so. In fact, I'll never forget going to Stubbs and watching you and Alex do Dig Nation.
That's when you did crowd surfed. Yes.
Massive live audience. And then as we're leaving, your mom and dad walked by. And they were glowing. And I know your dad passed a couple of years ago. I think it must be so gratifying that he got to see you do that.
Yeah, I mean, that was... It's funny because my parents are of the generation that they don't really understand the internet as well as obviously we all do. So to get them into podcasts or watching any video content online was always a struggle. And so I would say, you know, I'm doing this podcast, and I kind of didn't want to tell them. I grew up in a pretty strict household of, like, no swearing, and it was very religious, and I went to private school and things like that when I was younger.
Was it a religious school?
Yeah, it was a religious school.
Oh,
it was like a Lutheran, Christian school.
Yeah.
And so, you know, getting them seeing me, like, kind of drink beers and go crazy and talk about, you know, sex and all kinds of it did, but then when my dad saw the show,
that must have blown him away.
He was just like, I can't. Well, first of all,
you're a rock star.
My dad was always like the type of dude that would laugh at those jokes and make those jokes, but be like, you can't make those jokes. You know, it's like, do as I say, not as I do. And so he eventually kind of was like, okay, this is pretty funny, and this is cool. So, and then he saw that crowd and everything, and my mom saw the crowd, and they were pretty blown away.
I remember talking to them as they were walking away, and they were glowing. They were really proud of you.
It was cool. Yeah. It was. I'm glad my dad got to see that before he passed. It was pretty special.
Yeah. Now you were also a TV star. I mean, you were on first the Screensavers, then you actually hosted Attack of the Show. You hosted the Screensavers and then Attack of the Show. Did they feel like that was because that's real TV? That was more of a job.
Yeah, for sure.
That's a real job. Not this Dig stuff.
Yeah, I remember when I was. I told my family. I called them up and I said, you know, I'm going to go leave and follow my startups, which were
Revision
3 and Dig. And they were like, why would you, are you sure you want to do this? Why would you leave TV? Like, you know, this is the future for you. You're making great money. And it's like, you know, you could go on to do bigger and better things.
You're in Hollywood, man.
You're in Hollywood, yeah. And they didn't understand that, like, you know, there's so many people that come to television, and I'm sure you run into them all the time, like, they are born and bred to be on TV. It's like their dream in life. And that was never my dream. I didn't want to be on television. I fell into it. And it was really awesome, and I had a great time. But I don't think that geeks are naturally – they don't really want to be on TV.
They're
I was
shy.
Always really nervous and shy.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so I didn't see that as like – once we got down to Hollywood and they started changing the content on the show.
Yeah, they really did.
I mean,
too.
You saw how quickly they dumbed it down once they moved – all the tech TV folks down there, they wanted to make it as mainstream as possible.
Sure. Well, understandably.
Totally understandably, but that wasn't for me. And so I'd rather go and build startups and do other things. And I told them, like, it's okay, I'm going to go do this and I'll get some investors. And that. So I left.
And I doubt you regret that.
I don't regret that, no. I mean, it was fun. I mean, all these things are just like, you know, chapters of my life. And I just
You've
kind of
had an interesting, how old are you, 30?
37.
Oh, you're an old man.
33. I wish I was 33.
But you've had quite an interesting career with a lot of different things. What of all the things you've done, which is television, both behind the camera and in front of the camera, starting your own company, and you hired a programmer, and you built something really of value. We're on the cover of Business Week, $60 million man.
That was a crazy.
You laughed because you didn't get the $60 million. So, but anyway.
Yeah, that was a little misleading.
No, but I mean, really, truly, you're on the cover of Business Week. That's okay. I'm just going through your career highlights, and I'm probably missing a few. Milk. Google buys Milk. Dignation, hugely successful podcast. But in every case, you've ended it and said, I'm going to do the next thing, right? You were always in control of it. Mm-hmm. Now you're Google Adventures. You're helping entrepreneurs live their vision. Of all of those things, is this the thing you enjoy most, the Google Ventures thing?
You know,
you don't have to. They're not watching, so
yeah,
you can be honest.
No, honestly, when it comes to investing, you know, I had done angel investing prior to joining Google Ventures. So I know I enjoyed that. I like working with entrepreneurs, and hopefully, you know, you give them 8 or 10 different ideas, and they maybe implement one of them. You hopefully help them navigate the waters a little bit, not make the same mistakes that you did. So that's fun, but it's not really like...
You like to build things, don't
building
you?
Building things.
Yeah.
Building things is it's a different job.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, you know, one is you're sitting on the sidelines, you're kind of the coach, and, you know, at the end of the game, they're interviewing the star players, and you're just sitting there being like, well, I kind of helped out in a little way. But you're not on the field, so it's different. I do miss that piece of it. I still have little ideas that I mess around with, and I think that eventually, if I ever did anything else, it wouldn't be to leave and join another VC fund. Like, I think that Google Ventures is an amazing firm, and they really do have this just really good kind of altruistic kind of like vibe about the firm, that they really want to help out all entrepreneurs from all walks of life, and I really enjoy working with the team there. So it wouldn't be to join another VC firm. That's not that. If I ever did anything else, it would be to start something new.
A new startup.
Build new products. Yeah.
So let's go back. First of all, I didn't know that you went to a Christian school. Now there are Lutherans. I don't know if you were of this ilk that won't read comics, that won't play cards, that won't. Was it very strict?
Wasn't that hardcore?
Wasn't that hardcore?
No. I mean, it was hardcore in a lot of ways. And
pretty strict upbringing.
Pretty strict. Yeah. And it was. I eventually talked my family into letting me out of that and go to a public school when I was in high school, because I didn't enjoy private school, and I didn't really it just wasn't me.
You should wear a necktie and a little Christian hat. I don't know what a Christian hat is.
Christian hat.
We don't know what that would be.
Crosses on our hats, and you know.
When was your? Let's go. Let's drop that.
There was no dress code.
What? What was your first? When did you get your first computer? How old were you?
First computer was like an 8088. Actually, it was a Apple. Oh no, it was a Commodore 64.
C64.
And so I started.
So you were what? 8, 9.
Pretty
you
young.
Were pretty young.
And so I remember opening up the pages, and there was a little program that you could code that
type
would draw,
it
type
yeah.
it in, and it would draw a little blimp, and it would float around the screen and stuff. But
did you type it in?
I did. But the problem was that it wouldn't tell you what line the syntax error was on. And so it would just say error, and you'd just sit there and you'd be like, oh, boy. And so you'd have to go through line by line to figure out which line of code.
Boy, I remember that.
But the first real computer was the one that I had in my room, which my dad let me bring in my room, which was a Packard Bell 286SX16 with a little under 100 megabytes of storage.
So did you want the Commodore 64? I mean, were you saying, hey,
no.
I really want to get – no, you, it just happened.
It just happened. It was – my dad brought it in the house, and it was – I thought it was cool. But the first time I remember seeing computers, and just there were video games on them that you could install from floppies.
That's what got me
interested.
Yeah.
And so that was cool.
I wanted to play the games.
And I did typing. My dad tricked me and bought me some of those like Mavis Beacons, and it looked like a game. And I'm like, I'm learning how to type.
I didn't realize. Henry with that too.
I didn't realize I was like learning how to type at the same time.
Ooh, you're shooting down planes by typing Q.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that kind of got me hooked, and then I started playing with DOS and getting into the file system stuff and learning all the DOS commands.
Oh, so you enjoyed that?
I enjoyed that. I don't know why. It was weird. Who likes, you know, learning
DOS
the DOS commands? But I was just going through the pages and learning.
Did you write little shell scripts?
Bat files. Yeah, bat files. And, I mean, obviously I was tweaking all the AutoExec bat and config sys files to get the most of the memory so I could run some of the games. And, you know, you had to, like, rim out certain things.
Right.
And then I would go into QBasic and modify some of the little, like, Gorilla games and stuff that they had. And
so you had a little aptitude and interest in this.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And then I started building computers and all
so
that.
So by high school, you're pretty seriously in
this. Oh, for sure. I was building all my own computers by high school.
Oh, that's
and,
neat.
Like, I was really into it. That's when I started getting certifications. I got the A-plus certification.
In high school, you got an A-plus?
Yeah. No, it was right after high school.
After high school.
So I got
A-plus. Wow, I didn't even know you had an A-plus. Wow.
Yeah, I got A-plus. I got...
that's the general IT cert.
Right. And then Novell certified systems administrator, not an engineer. That was the harder one. So I was Novell certified, Microsoft NT 4.0 certified.
So you were aiming at an IT career?
Yeah. So I was doing a lot of... This is when I worked at the Nevada test site. It was the first time... I've worked at Best Buy for a brief amount of time, and I was, like, fixing all the computers there. This is before Geek Squad. This is when they just had a computer repair department.
Right, yeah.
And then I left there to work at the test site, and I was working out by Area 51. And I had to get my security clearance and all that stuff.
Oh, that's cool. So you didn't go to college. You just said, I'm going to do this.
I went to college, but I dropped out. I was taking classes part-time. I was studying CS, but... brain was too ADD to really kind of fully wrap around
like
that.
Like most of us, it was like, I want to do my own thing.
I just want to do my own thing. I just want to get into the workplace. It was frustrating because around this time is when the first kind of like, you know, .com things started to spin up. And I was like, well, I mean, people are becoming millionaires.
Right.
And I could continue with school or I can go off and do this .com thing. And so after the test side, I left and moved to the Bay Area in 2000. And that's when I really dropped out of school.
And the dot bust didn't deter you. You said, I don't care.
Well, it was right at the tail end of it. So I caught it. I was actually working at a CMGI funded startup, which was a big incubator back in the day.
So before you came to Tech TV, you'd already been doing this startup stuff.
Yeah.
This is not new.
I mean, I joined a 50-person company. I was a low-level, basically.
But you saw what was going on.
Yeah, I saw what was going on. It was very exciting. You know, I wanted to build something. I wanted to launch a thing. I didn't know what that thing was, but I had... so many different ideas, I just wanted to go out and try them and see what would happen.
For you, it was software?
Software, yeah.
You really liked software?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think by then it was software. It was like, I mean, we were still doing hardware until 10 years ago, but the software is really where it was happening.
Well, I mean, you were reading all these stories. Like, you got to remember that Jobs really hadn't kind of returned to his full glory at that point. So you're reading all these stories about Bill Gates. And, you know, you write software once, and then they would burn it to CD and ship it. And I'm like, well, if I could just write a program that a million people will give me $10 for, I'll be set. You know?
No manufacturing
it's kind
costs
of the
or
wrong
anything.
Mindset to have, but it gets you excited in the possibilities, you know. And so, like, this idea of just creating something one time and then just runs on everyone's machine was cool.
So you're in the Bay Area in 2000. How did you come to Tech TV?
Was
our IT guy. It was
Chris Krause. Yeah, so he told
me
about...
He was a buddy.
Yeah, I'd met him through a friend of mine, so we had a mutual friend, and then he's like, hey, there's an opening at Tech TV.
For what? What job did you get?
It was a production assistant behind the scenes at the Screensavers.
So this was a bit of a change for you, because it was TV. It wasn't about software at all.
Well, I mean, the job description was like, you know, configure Linux boxes
kind of IT
and
guy.
Like install the latest video cards and building computers. And I'm like, I can do all that stuff. That's fine.
Right.
And so I just wanted to have a job because I had lost my job that I had before. And
I just
wanted
a job.
Yeah, I just needed a job. And the pay was horrible. You guys
what
didn't
was
pay
the pay?
Me anything. $28,000 a year. And I was just like, man, to live in San Francisco on $28,000 a year
is not easy. 2000, it was not easy.
And so I lived out in the sunset all the way out in the middle of nowhere. Mm-hmm. I got my car repossessed, which I never told anybody, but I didn't have enough money to pay my car payment. But that's okay. They had public transportation, so I just took the bus.
Yeah, took the and Judah or the...
Yeah, yeah. El Terrabal.
El Terrabal.
All the way in from the sunset.
I used to take that, too. I took the J Church.
Yeah.
Took more time to get to downtown than it takes for me to come from Petaluma.
Yeah,
it's
I bet.
Like 45 minutes.
All those stops. And it gets packed in there, too, when you get in the morning.
But it's convenient.
Yeah, it was a job, and I was in the Bay Area, and it was like, it was cool. I mean, Tech TV was such a fun place. It was so alive. We were all like, you know that feeling.
Oh,
you just
so
walk
fun.
In, and everyone was just really enjoying their job, and we felt like we were making a difference, and you know, we'd get people calling in all the time. I was answering the phones. You remember that?
Yeah. You were one
of
our
phone
people,
picking them up and like people just it was clear how passionate people were about the programming. The people that loved us loved us. I mean, we didn't have that many people watching us, in the hundreds of thousands, I guess. Yeah. But like
under 200, but
yeah. So, but still, those people. I mean, they're still in the chat room right now.
They haven't gone away. Yeah. No, you're right, and that was something that you knew because you were on the ground. That I don't know if the executives really understood what was going on there, but you understood that because you were there. You were talking.
It reminds me of what Elon Musk said when they got rid of the electric cars and people were holding candlelight vigils around. You know, I think it was Chevy or whoever they got rid of their electric line. And he was like, there's something here. If people are this passionate about this space, there's something here. Then he went on to do Tesla.
That's a good lesson, isn't it? To look for people who are passionate.
Oh, absolutely.
To look for some area where people really, more than just a customer, they care.
Right, exactly. Which is the fan base that we were so lucky to have today. I mean, it's amazing.
And I think that was something we knew about, and one of the reasons that after Tech TV went away, we kept doing what we do.
Right.
It's because we knew that audience was there.
Oh, absolutely.
And we wanted to produce stuff for them. So we've told this story before, but I'm going to tell it again since you're here. As you were a production assistant, and you came, I don't know, was it came to me or Patrick or Paul Block and said, you know, there's a flaw in Microsoft Windows.
Yeah.
It was in the messaging.
That's right.
And you showed us. You were able to send messages to all these.
Yeah, you could spam anyone. It was basically just a way to send a little pop-up window to anyone's computer.
On the network,
yeah,
anywhere, not on your LAN, but anywhere on the internet.
Oh, yeah, you just use IP addresses. You could just write a little script that would go in and try one after another, and it would say success or fail, and you could send tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of messages a day to anyone's computer.
Yeah.
Windows had built that in as a way to message from computer to computer, but
it was
for
the LAN administrator
to
tell we're bringing the server down.
Right. Right. But it was open to everyone on the internet. So we contacted Microsoft. They didn't
You said, let's put this on the air. And I said, well, or Paul did. Paul Block was our executive producer. Let's tell Microsoft, see what they say.
Right.
And they said, yeah, we know about that.
Right.
It's not a problem. It's not a bug. It's a feature. They literally said
that's
that.
Right. So we talked about it on the air.
So and the idea, and this, I think credit Paul Block for this. Paul said, let's have Kevin do it. Why should we have Leo or Patrick tell the world about it? You discovered it. Why don't you show you? Were you pretty? Do we have? Can you, Chad, look and see? Because I think that's on YouTube somewhere.
It's on YouTube somewhere.
Kevin Rose's first appearance.
Man, I was so nervous going on.
Were you a little shaky?
First time. Oh yeah, of course.
I have to find Patrick Norton's first appearance on
television.
Call for Help. You visibly shaking.
Oh really?
You could hear in his voice the quaver.
That's
funny. He was so terrified.
Everybody gets freaked out.
It's just a little freaky.
It takes a while.
It's a little freaky. I felt very fortunate because I think of all the people at Tech TV, I kind of had an idea of how lucky we were because I'd worked in broadcasting for years. And so I knew this is not normal. This is a very unusual thing we're doing here. And no one else has had, you know, this is not what. And we had all these people coming out of college who thought this is what television's like.
Yeah.
No, you're working in San Francisco. Nobody gets to do that. You're talking to an audience about something that they care about and you care about, and you're not dumbing it down. This is unheard of. And the weirdest thing is management seems to just let us do whatever we want.
Yeah. That's pretty awesome. Yeah, that changed.
But that was amazing. Can you find it, Chad? I might have to look for it here on my YouTube.
Yeah,
I want to show. It's on YouTube, isn't it?
It should be.
I think I've seen it.
Yeah, like first appearance screensaver or something like that.
Kevin Rose, first appearance on the screensavers. Showing this Microsoft bug. All right, we're gonna take up some of your precious time. While I do that, maybe we'll do a commercial, and then we'll come back. Kevin Rose is our guest, partner, as you see, at Google Ventures. A very esteemed and august person who is changing the world through the internet. But you all remember him when? Just a young guy, straight out of Vegas.
That's right.
Teaching us all. It was Paul Block said called you the dark tipper.
Was it? I think it was.
It wasn't me.
You somebody.
It was Paul Block, and I don't think you liked it so much.
It was horrible. But it was fun. It was kind of my shtick.
It was a good shtick.
Yeah.
The idea was you were showing us kind of the dark side of the internet.
So I'd have to go and research all the crazy security tools and hacker tools, and I got a lot of people were like, you're just a poser, you're showing these tools off, you're not really a hacker.
Really?
Like,
Well, you know, I never claimed to be a hacker. I was just kind of like...
Hey, you're on TV showing stuff that is never before seen on TV. This is Patrick, though, right? What is this?
Cast it on the web. They're calling it IPTV.
Look at that hair.
Because IP,
look at that shirt.
That's a call for help. Wait a minute. This is Toronto or somewhere.
Yeah, this is what the chat room digged up.
Oh, boy.
This is old. This is...
That's not
this
me.
This is Canada, and that's it's not fake. Kevin Rose.
That's the fake Kevin, remember?
Who is that?
That's the guy that worked on your set or something, and he looked like me, and then they
so
brought
we
in
fooled
me
around
afterwards.
With it?
Yeah.
Yeah, oh, that's funny. Thank you, chat room, for that. But that's not even in San Francisco. I'd really love to find this. Oh well, you like broadcasting though, because you still from time to time will do a podcast.
Yeah, it's fun.
You have that great show. I can't remember the name now.
Foundation,
where you talk to startup founders.
Yeah.
It's really good.
Yeah, it's fun. It's not something I need to do more of them. Actually, I have one coming out like today, I think, or tomorrow.
Really?
With Biz Stone.
Whom? Biz Stone?
Yeah, so I sat down with him.
You know all those guys.
It's easy because they're all in the city.
Yeah.
They're all just right there, and you just grab them and grab them for 45 minutes. But it's a fun show to shoot, but we only do it probably once a month, once every 6 weeks, so not that frequent.
Here is an old one, but it's not. I don't think this is the one, but it's kind of funny to see.
That's your Windows password long hair is not
days
very secure,
especially for the gray hair.
You know, you haven't aged at all.
Are you
Kevin.
Kidding me?
That's the most important thing to know. Let me show you.
I had zero gray hairs back then.
Take a look at this right here.
Now it's like 90% gray.
And this is your Windows System 32 DOS config directory.
Prompt stuff.
This is where Windows passwords
see,
are stored.
See how good he is? So it was really apparent, even the first time you were on, I don't know how nervous you were, but the first time you were on, it was really apparent that you had this energy and this passion and this interest, and you were really able to communicate really well.
I'm just...
You're natural.
I don't know about that.
You're a natural.
I would go out and have, like, shots of whiskey before coming on the show. I remember the
Maybe
first
that's
time...
that's why you were so relaxed.
The first time I hosted the show... I remember someone called in sick. I think it was either you or Patrick. I can't remember. I think it was Patrick.
I'm sure it was Patrick. I was only sick once in 6 years.
Yeah, so it was Patrick. Or you were on vacation a few times.
Maybe that was it.
Filled in
yeah.
for you. But Patrick was out, and they're like, Kevin, you're going to host. And I was like, the show? Because, you know, Marty had done it before, and Sarah had done it before. And so I'm like, okay, God, what am I going to do? And so I went around the corner, you know, Slow Club.
Yeah.
It's a little bar
slash
restaurant.
We used to hang out there. It's still there, I think.
It's still there. Yeah. I go there every couple weeks. But I went in there, and I just had to have a shot. So I just did a shot right around lunchtime just to calm my nerves a little bit. And I was still freaking out. And then, I remember first time hosting the show, just going on there, and my heart was going to jump out of my chest. But it was fun.
Wow.
But I was not a natural. It took a long time to get comfortable.
You may not have felt like a natural, but I think you were pretty good. They found it. Wow, the chat room is good.
Yeah, I think I got it.
All right.
Oh, that's it.
Boy, oh, boy.
I did that little
chalkboard. See port 139? Yeah.
That was my best art skills back there.
He's usually over there in the Netcam Cineplex, but he's the guy who found this, and people probably don't know this about
him. He's on G4. This is weird. It's
the Netcam Cineplex. What a grandiose name.
And how did you find this hole?
Well, just playing around with a couple friends. You know, we like to take apart computers, just hack them, get into
right.
them. And,
you don't look nervous at all. Look how natural you are.
Department, good friend of mine,
definitely
just,
nervous.
Started playing around and actually started spamming some machines. Well, the first thing you have to do is you have to do a port scan.
A lot baggier jeans
back
then, too.
Which machines can be hacked.
You need my IP address. You
Correct.
Can't do it without it.
Right.
That was fun,
so
though.
What I'm going to do is I'm going to take a range of IP addresses right. and run a port scan for port 139.
This really shows
you, Kevin,
how...
look for you.
Right. How serious that show was. Oh, that's you know what that's from? The G4
the
Goodbye,
finale,
Kevin
yeah.
Rose.
The goodbye, that's right.
That's the goodbye. So this was them saying farewell to you on Attack of the Show.
That's right.
And they got clips from, because they owned them.
Yeah.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll find out more about what Kevin's up to these days. Talk about Dignation. And I'd love it if, I know there's a lot of people watching live, because we've tweeted it and let everybody know that you were going to be on. And if you've got questions for Kevin, we'll go to the chat room, too,
awesome.
In just a second. Our show today brought to you by Personal Capital. I feel like a little bit of a, I don't know, supporter of Personal Capital, because when its founder, Bill Harris, was on this show a couple of years ago, he announced Personal Capital. I signed up then, and I've been really thrilled. It comes down to an issue that some of you might say, oh, I don't want to talk about this, wealth management. Now, you may say, well, I am not wealthy. No, you don't need to be wealthy. The point is, you're going to retire someday, and you've got to start thinking about that. If you're young, this is the time. Because if you start saving now, if you start investing properly now, you'll be fine And I can guarantee you that you're not going to be able to count on a Social Security payment that's worth much when you're retired. Personal capital solves two big issues in keeping an eye on your net worth, on your personal investments. First of all, it's hard because it's on different websites everywhere. You've got your investments, but you have your mortgage, you have your credit cards, your bank accounts, and you each one a separate login. So the first thing it does, you sign into Personal Capital. This is free, by the way. You sign into Personal Capital, and you attach all your accounts to it. By the way, completely safe and secure to do that. And now you're going to get live real-time dashboard on your iPad, your iPhone, your Android device, your desktop that shows you where your money is, where it's going. And then it'll tell you if you're paying too much, whether you're having somebody manage it or whether you're buying mutual funds that are too expensive. It can really help you. The investment checkup, the asset allocation calculator, all of that stuff will really help you understand what you're doing in a great way. Now, they do have financial advisors. They're certified financial planners. They do not take a commission or a cut. They're there for you, and you can take advantage of that, but you don't have to. All of these services are free right here. This is amazing. And now they've got, and this is really cool, an Android. They're one of the very first to have an Android Wear application. So I, on my Android Wear watch, actually get notifications and stock information, investment information, right on my watch, giving you timely updates on your finances all the time, whenever you need it. Personal Capital shows you where you're overpaying, how to reduce your fees, how to get the best advice. They'll even give you tailored advice to optimize your investment. And it starts with a free account right now. PersonalCapital.com/triangulation. Personal Capital. It's free. It's the smart way to grow your money. Bill Harris, I think, really created something of great value. PersonalCapital.com/triangulation. Try it today, will you? Kevin Rose is our guest on Triangulation. We're talking about his multifarious checkered career. So what do you do at Google Ventures? I've always wondered that. What is your day like? Typical day for Kevin Rose.
So it varies from day to day. We have I'll break it down for you just so you know inside of a venture capital firm what it's like. So Mondays are typically what we call our deep dive days. And so if we have an investment that we're going to make that is over $250,000, a bigger investment, we'll bring the team in to pitch the partnership.
The startup founders.
That's right.
And they'll say, here, this is what we're doing.
So they have 1 hour, and they'll come down to typically Mountain View where we have our offices. And so we all drive down there, and we sit down and watch their pitch.
How many of you are there?
There's a total of, I believe, nine partners. Yeah.
You become a partner by putting in your own money, or is that just a title they give you? What makes you a partner?
Essentially, Bill Maris, who started Google Ventures, he was kind of our managing director.
And he came in. Legendary Silicon Valley investor.
Yeah, he's been awesome. And so he started the firm and came in and he selected the partners, kind of handpicked them, and then, you know, the partners...
I can see why he might pick you, because... You've been an entrepreneur. You've been a startup founder several times. You have a great design sense. They bought Milk.
Yeah.
Did they buy Milk because they wanted to make you a partner, or was that?
No, I ended up at Google Plus initially is where I first landed. So it was the Google Plus
team. So they bought
the
team is what they bought.
Yeah, the Google Plus team was the one that purchased Milk. And so
did you guys do that beautiful Google Plus app? I think that was already done.
We did the first redesign.
You did the redesign.
And then quickly... left.
We being Daniel Burka,
myself, and we had another guy, Chris Hutchins, that was working with us.
Chris, that's right, yeah.
And then we ended up all leaving, going over to Ventures.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Was that an offer that Bill came to you and said, get out of this Google Plus thing? How did that happen?
Gosh, I don't know how much of this I can actually go into.
Yeah, yeah. You don't have to. I don't want to, you know.
I mean, I think that, like...
reveal secrets.
So here's the deal. Google Plus has changed quite a bit over the last couple of years.
Vic left and
Vic left, and so Vic was the one that initially had hired me and brought
me
in. And you know, the thing is that through my entire career, I've been a product person. I come in and I typically help define how the features and functionality of a product. So that is working with a design lead, working with a developer, and coming up is this doable? How do we do this? Can we build this feature? Can we build this? And putting together a flowchart of functionality of how things will function.
Right.
And then eventually shipping a product. So that was my understanding going into it, that I'd get to define a lot of the feature set going forward of how things would function.
How exciting.
A lot of that was already predefined, yeah. And kind of a lot of that was being pushed down from other people onto us. And so, you know, there's a lot of product managers, and I would call them more project managers, that enjoy that role of having a feature saying, this is the feature we're going to build. Okay, I'm going to be the person that basically goes in and works with design and works with the developers and just ships a product. This is the date we need to hit, and then we'll push it out. I'm more on the product side in that I like the definition, defining the product and inventing the product, creating it from scratch. So that wasn't going to be my role, and that was my misunderstanding in coming into that. I thought I would get to have play a hand in that. And so I just didn't want to build another social network. Like, right. I think that the only way to win is really to create something different. Like, you can't right. be just a clone of Facebook or a clone of, you know, Snapchat or you name it. Like, those just never work. So the only way to really win is to innovate. And I feel that Google Plus had a lot of great things going for it. Specifically, I think the Hangouts were pretty awesome. They've done a lot of great work there. Some of the real-time conferencing stuff has been great. Some of the photo stuff has been awesome.
Amazing.
Some of the, especially around
Auto Awesome.
They purchased Auto Awesome, and they yeah. purchased Nick Software, right. which I was there for when they were
Nick's
doing
incredible.
That.
Incredible.
Incredible. So they have silos of brilliance, and it was like, but it's how do you – do you even need to package them all together and ship them as a social network?
And in fact,
I don't
since
think
you,
so.
Since you left, I think they've gone more in that direction where, and the Mark Zuckerberg's saying that too, you don't have to have a big blue application.
Right.
You have little applications.
Right.
That
and you
do
win.
What people want.
You win these individual battles. You make the best right. photo experience right. and you win at that. And,
right.
And so, you know, I was working on Stream and some of the other stuff, and it was clear that I wasn't really going to have any say in the product side. And so I reached out to Google Ventures because they had funded my last startup. They actually put money into
it. So you already knew
them. I knew them.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, I'm going to move on one way or the other. And so they were like, hey, what if you consider being an investor? And I was like, well, I do angel investing. I've done that in
right.
the past successfully. So sounds cool. Like, let's get to know each other. And
perfect.
So I spent some time there, got to know the team. And but to answer your earlier question about what makes a partner, how do they hire for partners? Typically, they pick people that have done really amazing things that they believe that can translate down and help entrepreneurs. So
they don't feel like, oh, what we're looking for is people who can look at a company and say, that's going to make money. Let's put money in there. That's not the most important skill set.
The most important thing is really, have they been there, done that, and done something amazing that will then translate?
And they can help guide
right.
this company.
So we have, like, Rich Miner is one of our partners. He was the co-founder of Android. Like, who better to talk
yeah,
to
no
if you're
kidding.
Building something in Android than
yeah.
the co-founder of Android?
Yeah.
You know, Joe has created Excite back in the day. Joe
right.
Krause was
Joe
one
Krause.
Of the co-founders
yeah.
and CEO of Excite. And
yeah.
so he's one of our partners. And, like, if you're doing something in search, like, Graham was also his CTO. Graham Spencer is one of our partners. And it's, like, just having this wealth of knowledge. So we kind of, like, look at these in different departments. So we have people in life sciences. We have people in enterprise. We have people in consumer internet, which is kind of my domain.
So, and they'll all gather on Monday to hear these pitches?
Right, exactly.
Wow. That's got to be scary for an entrepreneur. I mean, you're talking to, I mean, you look at these faces and you're going, I know who these people are.
It can be intimidating.
It's got to be terrifying.
It's like the cool thing is that all these people have been in their situation before. So some of the hiccups that happen, you don't really count against the entrepreneur.
Yeah.
If they are a little nervous
it's
or they
nice,
talk
isn't
too
it?
Fast, you're just
yeah.
like, I've been there.
Been there. Know
I
feel.
Know what that feels like.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's really kind of getting to the core of what they're trying to build. How big is that business going to be? I'd say the number one thing that we, especially by the time they make the partnership pitch, they've been pretty vetted at that point. So we know whether we're pretty kind of leaning in and wanting to do the investment. But oftentimes, you know, you'll look at a founder and you say, you have a great idea. This could be a $50, $100 million business, but it's not, you know, a multi-billion dollar business. And at Google scale and kind of what we're looking at, we have a $300 million fund every year. We're looking for the next multi-billion dollar, you know, world-changing company. A lot of the times we see, like, great little lifestyle businesses that we pass on, or at least I do, because they're not going to reach that scale.
Right, like Twit. Perfect example.
Well, I mean, you've self-funded, though, which has been awesome.
Yes. And
I always recommend that to entrepreneurs.
Really?
If they can pull it off.
Paul, I remember going at Foo Camp to listen to Paul Graham talk about it, and he said, you should never do this alone, and you should never bootstrap. And I was bootstrapping by myself at the time. And I thought, yeah, well, let's try it anyway.
I mean, but
there aren't any real rules, are there? There are no rules.
No, there's no rules. It's certainly every company is different. And, like, you know, I love the fact that, like, when you're in control of your own destiny, the problem with taking venture, and I love this that I can actually have this conversation with entrepreneurs because, like, this is the thing about just being honest with the founders because you've been there before, yeah. Is that, you know, after 4, 5, 6 years, the investors start kind of looking for an exit. They're like, how are we going to get a return here? What's the end goal here? So, you know, when you're self-funding, you can just go on and live a right. great business, pay yourself whatever salary you right. want, and, right. and just continue to do your thing if you're self-sufficient.
Well, and I think that's what happened at Digg. I mean, you kind of went through that experience at Digg of taking investors, and then the investors have some visions that may differ with your visions, and you have to go with it.
That was the one really pretty smart thing about – well, Reddit ended up going and then selling out. They sold for –
they were lucky because they sold to Condi.
They sold early for $10 million
didn't change things much.
Well, then
right?
they spun it back out.
Right.
So then they kind of didn't know what they had, I don't think, and then they spun it back out, and then it continued to grow from there.
Yeah.
But in not taking that money and keeping the team really small, you can kind of play to your strengths, and this is your core business. Like for us, it was like – the pressure was, how can we take this mainstream? How can we make this something that it's not? And that was the wrong decision. Like, we had a really quirky, weird...
happens every freaking time. That's what happened at Tech TV.
Right, right. How can we take this
how
bigger?
How can we take it bigger?
How can we get your mom excited about this? How can we, you know...
Once Google Ventures gets in, it is kind of the game to say, how do we take this bigger? You need to make it a $1 billion business. So that's kind of part of the deal.
Yeah, I mean, but we certainly look for businesses that it fits naturally to want to scale it out,
right.
you know, like...
And not all businesses can self-fund. Digg couldn't because you needed bandwidth, you needed servers, you needed some very expensive stuff to make this work.
Times have certainly changed quite a bit.
Yeah.
It's actually something that I'm looking at a lot lately. I think that in the... especially, people aren't noticing this, but, you know, we have had EC2 and servers from Amazon and things like that for a while now. And that's awesome because that took us from a world where, when I first started Digg in 2004, I was actually purchasing and racking my own servers.
I remember when you bought your first server and you put that in the colo.
Slide it in the colo
yeah.
and doing it. You had to get your own router, which was
yeah.
a pain to configure. And
now you don't even have to think about that. It's all virtual.
Right. But we're entering a new stage. So EC2 is the first step. It was like, you know, you launch an instance, you still have to configure it. You still have to like set it all up the way you want it. Now there's services like Parse that are out there. That there's services like, you know, Dropbox that are offering APIs to their data store. Apple's getting into the game now and opening up all this like insane amount of personal storage for your application storage. And it's like, you don't have to worry about the system administration and the scaling piece of it. You know, Snapchat's a great example. Snapchat came on and they launched, and they just used all Google scaling.
Right.
Like, they're all on Google servers. And they said, we don't need to worry about this. Google scales it.
Yeah.
And these, I mean...
Facebook's doing the same thing.
But it's crazy. Like, think about, like, the time to innovate is getting so much more compressed.
Right.
Because before, you had to rack and build and configure, and, like, that was, like, a multi-month process. Now EC2 cut that down to, like, you know, a month-long process. Now with Parse and some of these others, it's like you just write a few lines of code, and you say, magically scale me and store this in the cloud, and it happens.
That's pretty amazing.
It's amazing.
And it
so,
happens cheaply enough that you probably don't need to go out and get venture funding or angel
true.
Funding right
it's
away.
It's true. A lot of people can go and launch their first prototype without
yeah.
having any funding. Like,
yeah.
you can just go and build it. You
yeah.
know?
And that makes it easier to get funding because you can – you have a you can show customer base. You can show a working product.
Absolutely.
You can give them an idea.
There's two sides of thinking on this, though. Some are like, okay, get funding first,
mm-hmm.
You know, before you launch, because that way there's this expectation that this could be big, and it's easier to get funding than if it's kind of fizzles out.
It's always better not to make any money, because then you have a valuation based on what you made.
Yeah.
If you make zero, the sky's the limit.
It's crazy like that. But
but you guys aren't dumb. Look, you're talking to some of the smartest people in the business. So you are aware of all of this. Do you look – I've heard Paul Graham say, I look for a founder, not an idea. I mean, this is where you're vetting the team on these Monday meetings, right?
Yeah.
As much as the idea?
Well, so you have to think –
because you already know the idea.
If they've come to this level of pitching on the Monday meeting, it's typically a later stage deal.
Right.
So because they're raising more capital.
I see.
So it is partially the idea at that point. At the seed level, absolutely. It's all
about
the founder.
And that's the early stuff you did as angel.
Right. Because they're going to pivot 4 or 5 times
right.
or, you know, try different ideas. Some will work,
right.
some won't work. And it's so,
you know, then you are investing in the founder. People like Paul Graham, who have a startup schools, they're investing in founders.
Right.
Because that idea is not necessarily...
I mean, don't get me wrong. You love a great idea. Like, if you sit there and there's some original thinking, you haven't seen it done before, it feels right, it passes all the gut checks, you know, because it's not going to pass any of the metrics. Nothing's been launched yet. And you have an awesome team. That's like, wow, okay, let's do this.
It's kind of exciting. It's like really betting on a horse that's never raced.
Yeah.
It's like, that horse looks good.
I get really... I mean, this is part of the thing, the thrill of investing.
It's a little bit like gambling.
Is like, yeah, you just, like, start moving in your seat when you hear a good idea, and you're, like, drinking your coffee, and you're like...
So when you were an angel investor, what's the dollar amounts you're talking about here?
So I started off angel investing because I didn't have a lot of money when I first started. It was about $5,000.
Small amounts.
And that was a decent chunk of my overall net worth. And then, you know, as you
have
some wins.
So you don't have to be a wealthy person to be doing this. If you have a little discretionary income, no, because it's very risky.
Well, it's very risky, one. And two, back in the day, you had to be an accredited investor.
Right. Now, that's changing soon.
Yeah.
With the new Jobs Act.
The Jobs Act, right. So that was a little bit different. You had to have at least a certain chunk of net worth or a certain income per year in order to make these investments.
Soon, everybody will be able to do this.
It's happening.
That's scary.
It's happening on AngelList and some of these others where you have syndicates that you can back with little chunks, $1,000 here or there.
But that must have been fun. I mean, that is like – it is a little bit – like gambling, like going to a horse race and putting down $5,000 on...
especially when people think you're crazy. I love that piece
of it. So tell me about some of these early investments. I mean some
Twitter,
of them were huge.
Twitter was my most
Twitter,
successful.
For crying out loud. How early were you in on Twitter?
It was the series in between the... It was seed and series A. I bought some secondary from one of the original CTOs, this guy Blaine.
Before it was public... They had shares, and you were able to buy directly from somebody.
This was back in 2006 or something like that.
Six? That's when they started.
Well, it was seven then. Maybe it was about like 8 months after they launched, something like that.
Yeah, they launched in spring of 2006. So to see that something was happening in 2006, early 2007, I think we you and I knew.
Yeah.
Very early on.
Like you and I were battling it out for most followers.
5,000 followers was number one at the time. So it was clear that something was happening, although it wasn't clear how they were going to make money. It wasn't clear that it really was a business.
That's right.
So it is a risk still.
But it was clear that we were sharing information, and it was a new communications
something
platform.
Was happening there.
There was a seed of something there. It smelled like that, didn't it? But it was like
I smelled money.
The taste of Twitter. but you know what I mean? Like it felt really exciting. You were sharing little bits of your life. You were reading bits of information from celebrities. Like once a celebrity started to get on, I'm like,
Ashton was the one
that
kicked it off. Ashton Kutcher, your close personal friend.
I know Ashton pretty well. He's a good dude.
Yeah,
he's crazy smart. It's funny because he plays all these roles.
He plays doofuses.
He plays like you know, dude, where's my car and all that. Yeah. And you sit down with him and you have a conversation. And you're just like, wow, this guy is brilliant. He's a smart guy.
Yeah. So Twitter, that's not bad. Not bad. And you made some money on that.
Twitter
went public.
Was crazy. Twitter was
awesome.
The one that helped me.
I want to give you a fist bump now, but I'm not gonna. so what else?
I mean,
that's a pretty good
my
one.
First investment was in OMG Pop.
Oh my God.
Which was crazy. I thought I had lost money on that one.
And then they sold for how much?
Zynga several hundred million.
And went out of business immediately, pretty
much.
A year later, they shut them down.
Really crazy.
But that was the one, Draw Something.
Right.
And so did you invest in them before Draw Something was big?
Yeah, it was their seed round. So way back in the day, I'd met Charles, the founder.
So you must have... How can you know that they're going to draw something?
Well, you just look at like how crazy he was. Like if you look at his original games and things that he was creating, they were all flash-based, but they were really just innovative. Like I'd never seen anything like that before. And typically, that's a good signal. Like if you look at something and you're like, this isn't a Me Too product. This isn't Pinterest for cats. This is like something unique, you know?
Pinterest for cats? Has somebody pitched that to you?
I've seen everything. I've seen it all.
That's actually a good idea. I'm starting to shift to my Pinterest.
You're getting all excited.
Yeah.
but
so sometimes, not at these meetings, because as you say, this is very late stage, but there's sometimes people pitch you stuff and you just might laugh out loud.
You say no to a lot of things. You have to say no to a lot of
stuff. What percentage do you think?
I would say of the stuff that you actually, well, first of all, there's a bunch of stuff you don't see because you look at the pitch decks.
Of those Monday meetings.
Oh, gosh. I don't know. I'd have to look. The Monday meetings are
by the time they get there, this might be half, there, right?
I mean, it's, they're leaning towards actually wanting to do the deal.
Yeah, this is kind of the final gut check.
Well, some Mondays, like just to give you a sense, like today we don't have any meetings at all.
Because there's nobody there,
right? Yeah. So you know,
wow.
Sometimes we're packed, and the entire month, every single Monday we have three slots per Monday for these meetings. And some months are just completely jam packed with deals that we're looking at. And other months, like you know, we'll go a couple weeks without any meetings at all.
Huh. So there's an ebb and flow. Is there any way to determine? Is there any excuse for this? It just happens that way.
Oddly enough, the summertime, there's not much deals. There's not many deals
going
on. Slows down
in the summertime.
Slows down a little bit. A lot of VCs go on vacation in August, so that kind of slows down.
Nobody's around. So, okay, there's Monday down. You had your pitch meeting. Now what else? What else is your work week like?
Well, we have our partnership meeting on Tuesday, so we go in there for a half day and talk about just various things that are going on at the firm.
No entrepreneurs are there. It's just you guys sitting around.
Sitting around
discussing. What is that like? Are you around a board table?
There's a big table, seats probably.
So it's pretty business-like.
15, 20 people. Yeah, but we're all really laid back. So it's like jeans and T-shirts. Yeah. Like it's not stuffy at all.
Yeah.
And, you know, just a lot of like joking around, checking in on the status of different deals. So
you
we'll
must
talk
be
about
one of the youngest guys, if not the youngest guy there.
Yeah, I mean, we have a couple. Certainly I know Blake's younger than me. We have one younger partner, Blake
Byers.
That's
pretty cool.
That's
pretty cool. You must feel pretty good about that.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. It's a pretty young team in general.
Well, if you think about it, you want to invest in the internet. You're trying to reach a young audience.
Yeah, certainly young entrepreneurs are especially.
What are the categories, hot categories right now that you think?
The hottest ones, I mean.
Because apps are done. It's over with apps.
You're done with apps?
It's over. It's over.
You're not going to install any more apps?
Nah.
Hardware is obviously becoming very
Hardware's
hot.
Long. Hot?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm seeing more hardware
Mobile.
Startups now. I mean.
Oh, little doohickeys.
Yes.
Yeah. The Internet of Things, aka doohickeys. Okay.
I mean, there was a lot of talk about it, and now you just see actually devices are starting to crop up. And
this seems to be so early, though. This is a case where you see stuff, and you know the potential's there, but you don't know. I mean, it's very early still.
Well, the other piece of it is that we haven't figured out the manufacturing component yet.
Oh.
I mean, there's just. So when you meet someone that does hardware very well, someone that really understands hardware, Tony Fadell, who created Nest.
Perfect example.
He obviously did the iPod first.
Yeah.
You sit down with him and you talk to him about manufacturing hardware. You really have to understand what you're doing. You have to have boots on the ground in China. When I did an interview with some of the founders of Nest and we were talking with them on Foundation, they were saying how they send teams out to the plants.
You have to live in Shenzhen.
You have to live there.
Yeah.
You just can't, like, and a lot of the startups, a lot of the stuff that we see on, you know, Kickstarter and other sites, they can lay out the board, you know, the breadboard that's sitting there. They've designed something that does something cool, and then they kind of just close their eyes and send it off to China and just hope for the best.
Oh, good luck.
I mean, but you see this.
I've heard so many tales.
Devices that break, they don't ship in time.
Jerry Ellsworth tells a great story about, remember, she designed the C64 joystick. It had all of the Commodore 64 ROM code in it and all the games in it. And that's what they did. They sent it to China. They got it back, and one of the chips was just wired backwards.
Yeah.
It just was non-functional, and she had to make it work.
Yeah.
I mean, you got to go there. But that's even printing, you know. You hear people who print beautiful photography books, they often will go to China or wherever they're being printed and shepherd the process.
A lot of hand-holding going on there to get it right.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, even some of the pros, I mean, if you look at, like, the issues with the Jawbone Up that was breaking
Perfect
forever.
Example.
I mean, that's a...
Perfect. Jawbone's had such
companies
a
like
hard
a
time.
Billion-dollar company with all the resources in the world. And if they can't pull it off, think about just a couple entrepreneurs getting into the hardware game for the first time. They don't have the connections. It's really tough. So it's a tough line. A lot of young founders are attracted to that, and we see a lot of interesting concepts. But I don't know if they're going to ship on time. I don't know how high a quality they'll be. And so we're seeing more hardware incubators pop up to assist in that. PCH, who does a lot of the Apple stuff and some of the others, they made an incubator called Highway 51 or something like that, where it's more a hardware-focused incubator.
That's what we need.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm going to talk to you about crowdfunding in a second. We're going to take a break. Kevin Rose, our guest, he's a partner at Google Ventures, but you know Kevin from the Screensavers, from Dignation, from Revision 3. I'm going to ask about Revision 3, too, and a whole lot more. This was a Kickstarter project.
Yeah.
You know about Smart Things?
I do. I remember seeing that launch.
So cool. In fact, Gina was – I think I might have – I'm a sucker for Kickstarter.
I am too. I still back all this stuff.
Do you?
Yeah. I want it to exist.
You've got a business doing this. I know. You want it to exist.
You see that and you're like, that needs to exist. I need one of those. I don't care if it breaks half the time. I need one of those.
I just did that. I bought that stupid robot head that looks at you.
Oh, you did not buy
Jibo.
That thing.
Yeah, I know. I wasted $500. That's guaranteed. Funny. In the other room, I have the Segway with an iPad in it that walks around.
Nice. Did you buy the 3D printer, the little tiny mini one, the cube one?
I love that one. No, yeah, I didn't buy that one.
I bought that one.
I bought a sous vide machine. I'm waiting to see what happens.
I love sous vide. I sous vide all the time, by the way.
Yeah,
I love
it. And we've actually interviewed Kevin's wife, and she wrote that new book, which is wonderful, which
Foodist.
Is called Foodist. That's it. And Summer Tomato blog and stuff. So you must. We could talk about food for an hour easily.
Yeah, no doubt.
Do you cook a lot?
I just sous vide some steaks last night.
See, I got this new one. It chills the food until it's time to cook it.
Hmm.
Oh, what is that called? Is it the Mellow or the? I can't remember what it's called. It looks like a water like one of those
aquarium.
Yeah,
I've seen that one. Is that a Kickstarter?
Yeah, or an Indiegogo or
Indiegogo
something.
Or something like that. Yeah, I saw that one. Did you see the digital picture frame?
No. That's a dead category.
No. This one is so cool looking. And you can, like, pick out the artwork on your phone on a mobile app, and then it just automatically displays. And then the artists are making custom artwork for the frame. It's really cool.
Sometimes this stuff just – this is a good example. Really takes off. So it was just like you said. You look at it and you go, I want this to exist. Mm-hmm. We've all tried home automation. We've tried to cobble together different things, and nothing works with anything else. And it's just a pain. And, you know, you clap – and the curtains don't open, and the TV turns itself off spontaneously. So when I saw Smart Things and the Smart Things Hub, I said, this is what we need. This is a hub that talks to everything, so it kind of unifies all of your stuff. GE, Schlage, those great key locks that open when you walk up to them. Honeywell, that's the Nest's competitor with the Honeywell Smart Thermostat. Eon, of course it talks to Nest. Philips Hue, I love my Hue lights. It's a Wemo. Sonos, it works with If This Then That, so you can, you know, you can, I mean, you can put this all, it's the Lego for home automation. It all works together, it all connects together, and all starts with a smart hub. We actually have a deal for you. They offer these, they call them home security kits, because I think that people understand what that is, but really it's just the beginning of whatever you want it to be. The basic home security kit, $329, you get the hub. You get the motion sensor, which is they have all these little things. So this senses motion, somebody coming in the door, or, you know, so you could turn the lights on when you get home, or you could turn them off when you leave, or the garage, or the cat comes in the kitty door, and all of that stuff. You get the presence sensor, which is actually kind of, I think this is kind of unique. The presence sensor can go on a keychain. It could go on a cat's collar. It's a little doohickey that'll let them know when something is nearby. And you also get, and I love this the best... Where is it? Oh, here it is. This is the Smart Sense motion detector. It looks like one of those things that you'd attach on a burglar alarm to your window. It's mm-hmm. two parts with a magnet. But it also has built in an accelerometer. So it can sense all sorts of things. I mean, this is really, really slick. And this is that's the basic kit. You get three multi-sensors. Those are the ones with the accelerometer and all sorts of temperature and stuff like that. You get a Smart Sense presence sensor, a Smart Sense motion sensor, and of course you get the hub. Now, for a little bit more, you get all of that for the smarter home security kit, $479. You get the motion sensor, an additional motion sensor, a smart power outlet. That's great because now you plug stuff into that, and this makes it a security system, a siren strobe alarm, and the smartest home security kit includes all of that plus another presence sensor, power outlet, an outdoor light plug, and control power outlet. And we're going to give you all of this for 10% off, or any one of these for 10% off, at smartthings.com/twit. But use the offer code TWIT10 for 10% off. Smart code smartthings.com/twit and the offer code TWIT10 at checkout. It's not a Kickstarter anymore. It's a real deal. This is one of the Kickstarters that just that really happened.
That made it, yeah.
And this is a heck of a business for these guys. Smartthings.com/twit, and I have them all over my house, and I really have to say it solved a big problem for me.
Awesome.
Yeah. Do you have an automated home?
I have dabbled in that, but to your
earlier
point,
because it's frustrating,
it
right?
It is frustrating, and a lot of it's so proprietary.
Right.
If you get it, this is what you need.
Stuff. It crosses all of those boundaries, right?
Yeah.
So you got Zigbee and all that, and it all works.
I've got all the Nest stuff going, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, well, you have to, yeah. That's kind of necessary.
Yeah.
You got a new house in Portland. I'm sorry about that.
I ended up selling the property
back.
Did you? Yeah. Got out.
I figured you would. What a mess.
It was a little bit of a debacle.
And I know you, so I know that it wasn't your fault, basically.
Well, I appreciate that.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people did. So you bought a beautiful old home in Portland. It was 1890s or something?
Yeah, it was a really old home. And
were you going to move there?
Well, the idea is that we wanted something.
You want to have kids, don't you? Yeah,
at some point.
This is a house for kids.
No.
Big yard.
We were looking. We've always loved Portland because it's just the food scene is amazing.
Yeah.
And, you know, honestly, it's just like a tenth or a quarter of the price of living in the Bay Area. You can just get so much
Plus,
more for your money out there.
Protesters don't come outside your house.
You wouldn't think, although that happened up there.
It turned out. So, they followed you.
Yeah, you know, we found an old house and we purchased it and we looked at having it remodeled. And it was really old. And by the time the estimates came back, they give you two choices. One, you can take a house that they eventually discovered had a bunch of asbestos in it. Go try the best you can to remove that stuff and remodel the house.
Don't ever get in that.
Or, you know, you can knock it down and build a new house.
Right.
And so we were like, well, we had a contractor come out and look and make sure that there wasn't anything. Because people were saying it was a historic house. But you have to be able to point to something in the house that is historic. Like
I saw the pictures from the listing. It didn't look so historic.
Well, here's the thing. It was a really old home. That's different than being historic. It was, and so, do you know what I mean? Like,
yes.
You have to be able to point to something that is historic about the home. So there was an attorney that was, I guess, lived there at some point that was famous or something. But there was nothing to where we were like, well, we should save this home.
Yeah.
So we chose to have it knocked down and build something new.
People didn't like that.
The neighbors did not like
Petition.
It.
Petition.
They had the Easter egg hunt there for the last 20 years, and there was a lot of
sentimental
value around it.
You kind of walked in something that you didn't really know.
We didn't know the neighbors that well, and so we walked around. We actually went to their Easter party and talked to them for a bit, and it ended up being the neighborhood just like totally rejected the idea.
Yeah.
And
so
it got
the right
so,
thing.
It got so chaotic that we were like, you know, this is going to be a really hostile environment. It's starting to turn really hostile.
Well, you don't want to live there now.
Well, they called one of our contractors like Nazis, and they were like getting really like kind of like.
You're going to have a giant inflatable rat on your front lawn. You don't want that.
Yeah, we didn't
so
want
I'm
that.
I'm sorry that didn't work out.
I mean,
out.
It's, you know, it's better to know off the bat than rather get into construction and then have all this come out. So we're glad that it all worked out for
everyone.
Do you
want to get out of San Francisco? It's been really. You know, we talked to you after these protests out front, and they named you by name. They did everything but call you, you know, an evil capitalist pig.
Yeah, people were, for people that don't know, people were protesting because I'm a VC at Google Ventures, and they...
Google is seen as one of the negative players in San Francisco. It's a much more complex story than that. It's 7 miles by 7 miles. There's nowhere to grow. Nobody wants... You know, high rises in their backyard, so there's no new building going on or very little. And so there's a lot of pressure on housing prices, and it's a very desirable place, but it's always been expensive. You know that from the year 2000. This has always been a problem. But people who are getting evicted or people who feel like their rents are going up or just generally unhappy about that blame Google and Apple because they have buses that transport, because people want to live in San Francisco.
Right.
They want to live in Mountain View. There's nothing in Mountain View, there's great America. So, unfortunately, you became the poster boy.
Yeah, I mean, I was one of the targets.
Terrible.
And so they came out to the house and they protested. And it was a nonviolent protest. And, you know.
You went out and talked to them. I really respected that. I thought that was pretty impressive.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, I just sat down with them. I wanted to hear what they had to say. They're upset about rising rents. And I kind of explained to them when I first moved to the Bay Area, that was the same
you
issue
too.
For me. And, like, they were complaining about. A variety of other things, and
you can't make them happy.
Yeah, there was nothing I could really say. Like,
does that make you want to leave?
It doesn't make me want to leave. I love San Francisco. I think it's a great city, but I certainly would like some space to kind of get away from technology from time to time and just kind of like go and decompress.
Yeah.
So that's why we were looking at Portland. Is it actually has a great tech scene going on out there as well?
Sure.
And it looked like a little area where we could still keep our San Francisco place, but have a place to go.
Are you still looking at Portland?
We're thinking about it. We'll see. The problem is there's just no land available close to the city. You have to kind of get way out there.
Right.
So we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
No rush.
You know, it's beautiful up here. Wine country, very relaxed.
I was just thinking that when I was driving.
Yeah,
in.
I could see why Leo lives up here. Yeah, no. I'm just saying, you and Daria, you can move up here. Great place to raise kids. I'm not saying Petaluma. It doesn't have to be Petaluma. There's lots of, you know, Glen Ellen. There's lots of Just saying.
It's nice. There's lots of space for protesters outside. Well, so protesters are watching.
We built these windows. I was hoping people with protest signs would come, but no. It's just moms bringing their kids to the grocery store. So do you think you'll ever do Dignation again?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
You heard it here first, folks.
Yeah, I mean, I can't say that it would start up as like a regular
podcast. Once in a while?
Alex is hard to track down. Like, I
you're going to blame Alex for this?
No, I am, because I sent him a text like a week ago, and I was like, dude, we need to do a Dignation. Like, what's up? And he's like, well, let's talk next week. And then I never heard from Alex. You never call me. It's really upsetting.
Alex.
I've copied his hairdo and everything.
I know. You got the faux hawk. You're doing the whole thing.
It's like, that's an Alex haircut.
Is that a tribute
to
Alex Albrecht? That right there?
I miss him. And so I decided to do it.
I love it.
But seriously, though, I want to do a reunion show. It would be fun. I mean, we had so much fun doing that. We killed so many brain cells, but we had fun doing it.
You know what's great? You ended it before it wore out.
That's what we tried to do. Yeah, we wanted to not...
You went out on a high, right?
That was the goal.
That's hard to do. I mean, you look at every television show, they always do one too many seasons, right?
Yeah.
And so it's great. You left them wanting more.
It felt like the right time. We were just like... We were both just getting married, and we were transitioning into other stages of our lives.
What's Alex doing now? Does he have a show?
He's got a bunch of stuff. He's got his own little startup down in L.A. that he's doing in the video gaming world.
He was doing for a while. I loved the Warcraft show that he was doing. Yeah. That was awesome. But Dignation, everybody loves Dignation.
We need to do another show. It's been far too long now at this point.
And I saw, maybe it was on your Instagram. I never know if I could talk about what I see on people's social streams or not.
Instagram's totally public.
That's public.
You're good.
Okay. Sometimes I reveal stuff I see on Path, and then I realize, oh, I shouldn't have said that.
That's right.
Instagram, you said, you showed a whiteboard, and you said, it's great to be building stuff again.
Yes.
What's that all about? I got you, didn't I?
Yeah, you're not supposed to talk about that.
You don't have to talk about it.
I have like a few ideas that I just want to build. I love building products. It's just fun.
You want to do hardware ever?
No, I don't think hardware.
Software. You like software.
I like software.
Yeah, it looked like on the whiteboard. It looked like a mobile app.
We're just sketching out stuff.
I'm just saying.
We're sketching out stuff. I feel like.
I liked Milk. What was the name of that? Alex's.
Yeah, Oink. Oink was a fun idea. The issue is that I think that to say that you have the killer idea, especially in the consumer internet space, is impossible to do.
Yeah.
So the question is, how quickly can you launch something and then iterate and try new things around that idea or an entirely new idea? And like I was saying earlier, with Parse and some of these other things like SDKs
You can try it.
Fail fast. And so I think that at some point I won't want to launch at least two or three new things and just fail.
Can you do that in Google Ventures? I mean, would they allow you to kind of have your own little side project?
Yeah, I think that if I got serious about it, I'd have to figure out the right scenario.
Right.
I mean, my full time gig, I was doing that over a weekend. My full time job is certainly
they want you focused.
They want me focused on that. So
yeah.
If it ever turned into something serious, then I would have to have a conversation.
Yeah.
But
You know, I sometimes you look at and you say every app has been invented. And Kevin Kelly wrote a great piece on Medium this weekend saying, oh, no, this all just started. This is the earliest possible days. Do you feel like it's hard to come up with a new idea, or are they just coming like that every day in the shower, just boom, boom, boom?
No, it's hard to come up with a new idea. I think that...
And then you look at things like Yo, and you wonder, really, is that the next big thing?
Sometimes there's these ideas that are created that initially seem really silly.
Yeah.
And
Yo seems really silly.
But if they're left open-ended to where they can be extensible, then all of a sudden people start using them in very unique ways that you never thought
possible. That's what happened to Twitter.
Yeah. Twitter is a great example because I don't know. I'm sure you remember this. When we first started using Twitter, it was like we were talking to our friends in some ways. Right. Like if I look at some of my earliest tweets, I'm like, who wants to meet me up at the bar and have a drink?
They thought it was text messaging.
Yeah,
they didn't know what it was.
Right. And then all of a sudden, now look what's happening in Egypt and all these other countries.
And users created at replies.
Right.
They created hashtags.
Right.
And then Twitter was smart enough to incorporate them.
Exactly.
Always a challenge, though, because you create something like Snapchat and it just explodes. And then you don't want to be the fad. You don't want to – so you want to add stuff. But at the same time, you add stuff, as Snapchat has done, you can ruin it.
Right. And you ruin the original experience, yeah.
That happens.
Sometimes I think there's just a natural curve. Stop fighting it. Like Snapchat, maybe that's it. I mean, certainly draw something. That was it.
Yeah.
And there's just a natural curve. Ride the curve and then do the next thing.
No, I agree with that. I mean, if you take a look historically at how consumer internet trends have happened, that's just that. I mean, think about MySpace or Friendster or any of the others. It's like there's this wave where you have a window in time. Sometimes that's 2 weeks, 4 weeks.
Right.
Sometimes that's 6-7 years. But eventually, you kind of have to either fade away or buy your relevance. I think, honestly, Zuckerberg is making some brilliant moves. Because
he's an example of something where he wants to hold on.
But he
doesn't want to be
in
MySpace.
The right way. He's not saying, well, let's just take Facebook and like keep adding on and changing it and like we'll make Facebook always be relevant. Facebook might be their least relevant asset in 10 years. And it might be the fact that they own Instagram and they own like all these other, you know, the next 10 properties that he ends up buying. They might just become a holdings company where they go out and just buy the latest, hottest, greatest thing that's out there socially. And they're really good at that. They're like a big VC firm.
Oh,
you
that's
know?
Interesting. It's the innovator's dilemma. You come up with a great idea. It's hard to get to the next idea because you're making money on the great idea.
Yeah, and it's really tough to have a second hit, too.
Yeah.
If you take a look at a bunch of I can name the founders from Airtime, you know, that had created Napster originally, to Chad and Steve at YouTube, to myself included, to have that second
Look at Chad and Steve. I mean, they made a lot of money on YouTube, and then they haven't really been able to find the next.
We're all like that. It's like
it's hard.
Not. It's especially in consumer internet. It's a very fickle space, and it's like there's always like you just have to.
Is it luck?
A piece of it is right place, right time, somewhat of a unique idea. You know, it's like being able to try and find that little tiny insight that no one has exploited yet, that no one has like built into something that a lot of people want to use, and then running with that and getting it out before anyone else does.
What would you do with Yahoo?
Oh,
here's an example, right? Perfect example of a company who crested and hasn't really been able to figure out what to do next, and yet they're still a valuable asset.
Yahoo's tough.
That's a tough one, isn't it?
Yahoo's tough because I like the fact that Marissa's come in and put a focus on building like best-in-breed applications. Like she's done a great job with the Flickr and kind of revitalizing that, the Flickr.
The Flickr is fabulous. It's right up there with the Twitter and the YouTube.
That's right. But she's done a good job with the brand. I think that she's put her attention to detail and her eye on design has been really smart.
She's done as well as anyone could be expected to do, but whether it will be enough.
I'd love to see them innovate in search.
Me too.
That would be really cool.
Wouldn't that? We need. You're coming from Google and saying that?
That would be pretty awesome. You know what? I know what I would do with AOL.
What?
I would make so AOL needs to like make the best email ever. Like they need to make at AOL email addresses cool again. Like
because everybody
like,
has one.
Make
or
like
lots
unlimited
of
storage, super
something,
geeky,
do something great,
over the top, like really hardcore to where it's kind of cool to have an AOL email address again.
Wouldn't that be something?
But imagine like saying I'm going to take. You know how Gmail has like a lot of little geeky tools in the lab settings and things like that. And it's like it's kind of the geek's email, right? We all use Gmail,
right?
Like what if you just took it, like said I'm going to be Google's game and take it and make it super geeky.
They got the resources to do it.
Yeah,
that's
and I'm
the
like
funny
I have
thing.
To have an at AOL email.
That's the retro email to
that's
have.
That's right.
The sharing, for a while, everybody said the next space is sharing. Airbnb, Uber, Zipcar. Airbnb is still going strong.
Yeah.
What do you think of that space?
I certainly believe that's one of our biggest, it is our largest investment is in Uber that we did a couple years ago. And we certainly believe that we're just at the very beginning here.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
I mean, think about Uber and where this is going and the fact that, I mean, even in San Francisco, the price of an Uber is so much cheaper than a standard taxi cab.
Is it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
It's less than a cab? Oh Uber X
quite a bit. Uber X, yeah.
Yeah.
But we don't have to have car insurance anymore. We don't have to have cars. I mean, and then imagine where that's going on the Google side with the self-driving cars.
Yeah.
And then even, I mean, there's so
there's
much
something
you can
happening
do with
there.
That.
Yeah. A car, you press a button, a car shows up, nobody's in it, shows up, you have it for the day, you go
to
the wine country.
I would
country,
imagine that's the future.
You and Daria have a nice meal, and you come home, and then you let the car go because we don't need it anymore.
I love it. No
and
drunk driving.
And what a waste. Yeah, no drunk driving. What a waste. All this metal. Everybody has a car or two.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a waste. You didn't get your new car repossessed, though.
No, I did not. I've cut back on. I'm.
You had some nice cars for a while. Are you now driving a? What are you driving? A Prism?
No, I'm actually waiting for the next Tesla. I pre-ordered the X.
Yeah, that's going to be nice. One. Yeah.
I'm excited for that.
You are having kids, aren't you?
No.
Yes, soccer mom Daria.
That is not a soccer mom car. It has, cool Back to the Future.
It's a hip soccer mom car, but it's soccer mom. It's SUV, dude.
It is. I said SUV. Tesla's such a cool. I love Tesla as a brand.
They're one of the best brands
in the last 10 years.
Aren't they amazing? And it's Elon, isn't it?
Yeah, it's Elon.
He's a really interesting guy.
He is like the Stark, of our generation.
So your new foundation that's coming out tomorrow is
BizStone. Yeah, it should be out
BizStone.
Now or tomorrow. Or
now
something like
and
that.
Where do people go to find that?
Foundation.kr.
Okay, KR for Kevin Rose.
Got my own extension
at Kevin Rose on the Twitter.
That's right.
Anything you want to plug?
No.
You don't need to plug
anything. I don't have anything to plug.
You're just an amazing guy. And no, I'm so.
Thank you for having me.
I have no reason to say I'm proud of you, but I am proud of you. I just feel like it's been so great to watch your trajectory. And what's fun is you really feel like there's more to come and there's some really interesting stuff. And you found your thing. And everybody, I think, the best thing you can be is a creator of some kind.
I
right?
agree with that. Absolutely.
That's if you really live up to your fullest potential, you're creating something. And that's what you're doing. And you found your medium, which is, software.
I think at the end of the day, I think a lot of people would feel the same way. It's like if it doesn't even matter if you fail. One of the things that I realized from a lot of the entrepreneurs that I've interviewed on Foundation is that they have all failed so many times. Like everyone that's created something amazing has failed, in so many ways prior to whatever that was that they're known for. And I feel that At the end of the day, as long as we are just getting out there and trying and building stuff, I want to be known, hopefully on my tombstone or somewhere, that I just tried a lot of crazy things. I don't really care if they succeed or fail. I just want to be known as trying mad, crazy ideas, And some of them are going to be really stupid, and the internet's going to be like, why in the hell did he build that? But at least it's different and new and pushing things in different directions.
And what a great sense of freedom that you have the permission to try stuff.
But everybody has that permission. That's what my job is with, and that's the best entrepreneurs. The entrepreneurs I sit down with that I want to invest in, that I'm really excited about, are the ones that aren't just looking at what somebody else has done and saying, well, if I just did this little thing here, that might be a success. It's the ones that are the crazy, brilliant, out-of-the-box thinkers that are just, going to try something that no one has done. And they may fail and they may be the front page. I mean, for as stupid as it is, it's like they create. I see what they were trying to do
great.
With making it extensible, and now people are using it for earthquake or hurricane warnings and all kinds of stuff. And there's some utility coming out of it. Don't get me wrong; I'm not investing in Yo. I can appreciate the idea of creating something that's that a lot of people are going to make fun of.
Neat,
because it's different,
Neat, Kevin Rose. So it's so nice to have some time with you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
Give my
best
to Daria and the kids.
The kids. You mean Toaster is what you mean.
And Toaster. I mean Toaster, of course. We do triangulation every Monday morning, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 1800 UTC on twit.tv. Tune in live if you can. If you can't, we've got on-demand audio and video for you after the fact. On our website, twit.tv/TRI. And, of course, if you subscribe, and there's so many places you can do that, you'll get every episode, Stitcher, iTunes. We have many apps from our very nice third-party developers on all the platforms, iOS, Android, Windows Phone, even Roku and Samsung TV. So find one, subscribe, you'll get every episode. Thanks for joining us. And we'll see you next time on Triangulation. Bye-bye.